This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we'll visit with George Washington University political scientist John Sides. He has some reflections that are detailed in his book, The Gamble, about the 2012 presidential election. President Obama defied the odds and won by right at 5 million votes in an election that was thought to be a cliffhanger and one that his opponent thought he would win on election day. We'll talk with John Sides about whether or not the Obama rout has any relevance to the current squabble over the government shutdown. Also, Bernie Pinsonat, the well-known pollster from Louisiana, on the politics of the government shutdown and how the 2014 Senate race could be affected. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside our area, please call 877-217-5757. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. We start with John Sides, political scientist from George Washington University. His book is The Gamble, related to the 2012 presidential election, Choice and Chance in the 2012 presidential election, won by President Obama by almost 5 million votes. The president got a few votes short of 66 million votes last year, while Mitt Romney received 61 million. Good morning, John Sides.
Thank you for having me, Jim.
Now, you go into detail about why things turned out as they did, but it's been well reported that on Election Day, Mitt Romney was under the impression that he was going to win, even had written a victory speech without regard to a possible concession speech, if that is accurate, and he loses by what amounted to a rout. How did this happen?
Well, I think one of the most important things that helped Barack Obama and hurt Mitt Romney was that the economy was growing just fast enough to reelect an incumbent president. It was by no means a great or robust economy. It certainly made things in the early going uncertain. But I think ultimately the trend in the economy over the election year just never really worked to Romney's favor. And I think he ran a vigorous campaign. He's outspent the president. He and his allies outspent the president. But ultimately, all that spending was just not enough to move the outcome away from these underlying economic fundamentals.
Is there any validity to the reports that the Romney vote just didn't turn out as anticipated, that if the election had turned out proportionately as far as how projections had been for turnout, that the outcome would have certainly been closer than it was?
I don't think there's very good evidence that Romney was hurt by turnout. If you look at turnout across different ethnic and racial groups, it was down in among all of these groups. It was down among Latinos more than so than it was among whites. In some sense, I think 2012, for whatever reason, was just an election in which fewer voters were stimulated or mobilized to go to the polls. Turnout was lower overall, and I think it was lower among most ethnic groups. And, relatively similar ways, enough so that I wouldn't say that it was a failure of turnout, ultimately, that doomed Romney.
We're visiting with John Sides. His book is The Gamble, Choice and Chance in the 2012 Presidential Election. Nate Silver says it provides the definitive account of what really happened and what really mattered in the campaign. What did really matter in the campaign?
I think if you're looking at the general election campaign, one of the important things that the campaign did was help bring partisans back into the fold. When we started our project in December of 2011, 15% of the 45,000 people that we surveyed said they were undecided. But if you looked at the attitudes of those people, they weren't political independents for the most part. They were actually partisans. They were mostly Democrats and Republicans. They were just sort of dissatisfied with either their party's candidate or with the way things were going in the country. But what happened over the course of the campaign is that those people came home. Their views of the candidates started to change. The undecided Democrats, you know, lo and behold, decided they liked Barack Obama a lot more and Mitt Romney a lot less. And the opposite was true for undecided Republicans. And so at the end of the day, the campaign did what it's been doing since the first, you know, major academic studies of campaigns back in the 1940s. It serves to crystallize and to reinforce people's natural underlying predispositions. That's not a very sexy effect in some sense because it's predictable, but it's extremely important. If for some reason that group of 15%, that group of undecided voters, had broken for one candidate or the other in a really lopsided way, that could have thrown the election to Romney or to a different candidate. But in this case, that didn't happen.
Democrats have received more votes than Republicans in five of the last six presidential elections. Is that a trend that will continue, or is it something that is just one of these waves that comes and goes? And I say this because those of us who are old enough remember Reagan won in 80 and 84, and Bush won in 88. Nixon had won in 72 and 68, so the Republicans had won five of the preceding six elections as far as the popular vote. What's going on as far as how we can look ahead to the next few elections, particularly the one in 2016?
So I think the first thing to do to answer that question is to look at the broad sweep of history, since we have had the two parties, Republican and Democratic parties, back to the middle of the 19th century. And if you look at that broad history, it confirms the pattern that you just illustrated by contrasting recent Democratic successes with Republican successes in the 1980s. That is to say, power oscillates back and forth from one party to another party. If you look at the post-war era after Franklin Roosevelt, you know, only one time has a party been able to hold the White House for more than two terms, and that was, you know, from 1980 through 1992. So I think if you look at 2016, the first thing I would say is, you know, Democrats should not be overconfident. I don't think there's anything about the 2012 election that signals some sort of, you know, imminent Democratic dynasty in the White House. If the conditions in the country are not very good for Democrats, that is to say, if the economy is not growing very strongly or it's shrinking, the president's relatively unpopular, you know, these things might advantage Republicans. If you take this tendency of parties to trade back the White House after, you know, roughly 8 years seriously, then the Republicans have an advantage walking into 2016, you know, above and beyond what the economic or political conditions in the country are. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's not a firm prediction about who's going to win. It's just to say that I think that we would expect perhaps a more level playing field than some of the triumphalist narratives about the 2012 election would suggest, where it was almost as if, you know, this was the beginning of some period of Democratic power.
We're talking with John Sides, the author of The Gamble, also a contributor to The Monkey Cage. His book is about the 2012 presidential election. Now, the 2012 election occurred after Obamacare had passed, and president still won by a convincing margin, but yet there are those in Congress, I think it's evident, who view him as a less than legitimate president. Why is this a case for a man who's won two elections by substantial margins?
Well, I think that view is a fairly convenient way to rationalize, you know, sort of an ongoing commitment to a certain set of beliefs and a political agenda that's very much in contrast to what the president's done. I think something that minority parties like to tell themselves after they've lost an election by 5 million votes. You know, there's no doubt that Barack Obama was a legitimately elected president. I think the one thing though that it's important to keep in mind when we're trying to interpret what an election means for public policy, there's no doubt that Barack Obama's victory helps him cement the policy legacy of his presidency, including the Affordable Care Act. But at the same time, what the political science research on voting tells us is that for most voters, when they're at the ballot box, you know, they're not voting based on really detailed knowledge of policy and the two opposing candidates, policy views, the two parties' platforms. And so it's always, I think, a fairly misleading proposition to interpret an election outcome as a ratification of the winner's policy agenda. And I think the 2008 election gives us a good example of why that's the case. I think that there were very good reasons for Barack Obama to pursue health care reform. He had promised to do so in the 2008 presidential election. It had been a longstanding priority of the Democratic Party, and he had the votes to do it, and then they did it. And maybe that's the right policy from the perspective of doing the right things for the country. However, I don't think the public's response to the Affordable Care Act suggests any kind of broad-based mandate emanating from the 2008 election. Public opinion about that's always been very polarized. The opposition to the Affordable Care Act tends to outweigh support for the Affordable Care Act. So that's just to say, I don't think there's any reason to dismiss Barack Obama's victory as illegitimate, but I don't think there's any reason to say that it's a validation of all of the different planks of the Democratic Party's platform.
Rose in Sherwood Forest. Rose, you're on the air. Please be brief with John Sides.
Yes, good morning, Mr. Sides. I just wanted to ask you a question. What do you think about the third party movement, not the Tea Party, but, like the independent, but the libertarian? What do you think are the prospects of that coming out since both parties are so helpless right now?
It's an interesting time to think about that question because, obviously, dissatisfaction with politics runs deep these days. And I think that the challenge that emerges for independent candidates or for third parties in that environment are two. One is just the traditional disadvantage they face because of the rules of the American electoral system. When we have candidates who win by just simply getting the most votes, that gives a very strong incentive for only two parties to really rise to the top because people are afraid of sort of quote-unquote wasting their vote, voting for a third party or an independent candidate that's unlikely to win the election. And that structural disadvantage is not going away anytime soon unless we're going to overhaul the rules of the system. I think the other thing that's hurting third parties today is underneath that broad dissatisfaction with the political system is actually a very partisan viewpoint, which is to say Democrat voters don't blame Democratic and Republican politicians equally for the dysfunction. They blame the Republicans, and Republican voters blame the Democrats. You can see that in polls about the government shutdown right now. And so I think the challenge then is that for a third party or independent movement to come along, there's not really that many voters who are actually honestly willing to say, a pox on both houses. I think for the most part, if people are dissatisfied with the system, their natural inclination is just to want to vote the other party out.
Chris and
third party in.
Chris in Prairieville, you're on with John Sides. Good morning, Chris.
Hi, good morning. Very timely topic. I wanted to ask the question, in light of the plethora of technology and information that's available to us, it seems like we're in an age of the low information voter or a time when voters have very little actual comprehension of issues and sometimes even basic facts around these issues. Do you see that there will be a time where maybe that will subside or we'll get to a point where we're actually discussing issues, or is this just going to continue and get worse as we proceed?
Chris, it's a very good question, and I think there's a lot of disheartening data that you can look at out there that points to a lack of comprehension of facts, from things about policy like the Affordable Care Act to this sort of fairly stubborn beliefs about the president's birthplace or and religion and things like that. It's an interesting question whether the American public has ever really been a true exemplar in terms of this ideal of being an informed electorate or voting based on these issues. At least in the political science research, there's a fairly kind of consistent, somewhat pessimistic view of the public in that sense. So my instinct is to think, maybe today is not necessarily any worse than it was before, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's good. Unfortunately, that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to get better either. I think one of the things that people say, though, and this is something that's far too complex to talk about, in this kind of compressed format, but one of the questions that people raise in response to this pessimism is to say, are voters really doing that badly?
We'll be back with John Sides and also hear from Bernie Pinsonad when we return in 90 seconds. This is Jim Engster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. John Sides, professor at George Washington University and author of The Gamble, is with us for a few more moments. 297-5633, 877-217-5757. And in a moment, we'll hear from Bernie Pinsonad, the well-known pollster, about the political implications of the government shutdown and much more. Dan downtown. Dan, you're on the air with John Sides. Hi, Dan.
Hi. Could the unpopularity of Obamacare be attributed to a propaganda campaign on the part of the insurance industry bent on keeping its hold on its profits?
In this case, I think that if the unpopularity of Obamacare is due to anything, it's due not so much to the insurance companies, in some sense, who actually were brought to the table and some would even say bought off in order to get their support for Obamacare. After all, a lot of giving people health insurance is going to mean additional people paying for insurance with these companies. I think the more important thing is just that the very concerted opposition of the Republican Party has meant that if you look at public opinion about this and you look at the polarization, it's Republicans that are really making up the staunchest opponents of this. In my mind, the only thing that's really going to bring about more sort of robust popular support for Obamacare is for the opponents of Obamacare ultimately to stand down and say, this is the law of the land, there's nothing we can do about it. And once they do that, I think you'll see some of that opposition start to wane among voters as well.
The book is The Gamble from John Sides, and we thank you for joining us today. You mentioned that Mitt Romney outspent President Obama last year in the 2012 election. What was the final tally on the amount spent?
If memory serves me, I think that Mitt Romney and his allies, including the independent groups on the Republican side, spent about $1.1 billion, and the president and his allies spent about $1 billion. So, when you're talking about that much money, it seems almost sad to say, but a $100 million difference actually doesn't amount to very much. And so both candidates actually raised and spent, roughly equal amounts of money.
Well, thank you, John.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you for having me.
Talk to you later. Bye. Now we're joined by Bernie Pinsonat. So we had the most expensive presidential election in country's history last year. And we're probably headed for the most expensive U.S. Senate race in Louisiana history next year. What do you think about Landrieu and Cassidy and Rob Manus and perhaps Bobby Jindal? What do you think?
Who knows who it will be? Well, I think it's obviously there's a lot of money. There will be a lot of money flowing into Louisiana, the parties, the PACs. It's one of these seats that'll determine if the Democrats hold on to the United States Senate or if they don't. So it's a big election, and Louisiana will be right in the middle of it with a lot of money and a lot of ads. We're going to be bombarded with, probably total spent maybe $40-50 million before it's all over with.
I think that might be a conservative amount.
Well, that's the bottom line of just the parties. God knows what the independent PACs and all those people mm-hmm. will spend.
Well, Mary Landrieu a few weeks ago said she needed $15 million to run a viable campaign. I'm sure she'll have that and more, as will Congressman Cassidy. And there's still the possibility that others could get in the race other than Rob Manus, who also will raise some money, but there is still the idea by some that Bobby Jindal could be a late entry into the race. Is with each passing day, is that less a possibility, or is it still a viable prospect?
No, I don't. He just, for whatever reason, you talk to him or I haven't talked to him, but I've talked to Timmy Teeple and anyone that talks to his guy, Timmy Teeple. They don't seem interested, not at all. They have no plans, no interest, and I think he has his sights set on something bigger. He went to Washington, was a congressman. I think he could have been a senator before this, but he chose not to run.
Yeah, he does have his sight on the White House, but how does he get there? That's the question, and it might be beneficial for him to be a U.S. senator, because if he's unsuccessful in 2016 in his quest for the White House, he doesn't have an office anymore, so I don't know. Some would think he might be better situated as a U.S. senator. The question, Bernie Pinsonat, who for 23 years, along with Buster McKenzie, has been running Southern Media and Opinion Research, is could the governor win an election in Louisiana right now? I don't know.
I don't know. It would depend on who. If he ran for governor again.
Senator, or, I'm sorry, go ahead.
If he ran for governor again and he had just about any Democrat, he could, I would say the chances would be better, better than 50-50. But you run for the United States Senate against Mary, it would be an interesting race. I don't know. I mean, I hadn't even seen a poll on it, so I have no idea.
You could do a poll, which I'm sure the governor would appreciate. It would probably would. He may have already done some internal polling.
Look, they're polling much more than I am.
They do this polling and don't talk about it sometimes. But the 64 parish tour, it probably materialized after a poll was conducted of some kind.
The one we did. It was actually the poll Grigsby did where his popularity had plummeted because of primarily the health care and the charity hospital system, which, by the way, I don't know what his numbers are now, but I think you're going to see some type of rebound. And in the long run, if you're noticing they're spending a lot of time on the so-called conversion away from the charity, which, by the way, I think in the long run will be the better part of his legacy. I mean, we had a dual system, expensive. And if you're talking to, I saw where Sharon Broom and Katrina Jackson, they're both saying the conversion with the poor having better access to better hospitals, wider array of doctors. So that thing is turned around, and that may be what he gets his most credit from in the long run, because that was a mess. The charity hospital was outdated and expensive.
297-5633 is your number for pollster Bernie Pinsonat. When will you do your next survey?
Probably start it pretty soon. We're looking at the issues right now. We'll check out who in Louisiana is doing, who's winning the war of words as far as the shutdown, and then the next thing we have up is the debt ceiling. We can look at Jindal's popularity, probably a look at the United States Senate race, but I'll caution people on the Senate race. I don't really think the horse race is going to tell you a lot right now. If you looked at the horse race and I were advising Mary Landrieu, I almost have to tell her not to run when she's literally dead even with a guy that nobody knows. Maybe when he gets better known, he'll be less liked. You never know. So polls right now really don't tell you a lot except that Democrats aren't doing that well in Louisiana.
Well, we know that, but Mary Landrieu has defied the odds in the past. She's won three relatively close elections, one that was razor tight with Woody Jenkins. She beat Susie Terrell, and she beat John Kennedy. Now, 11 years ago, when we had some strong Republicans running for various stances, John Cooksey, Tony Perkins, Susie Terrell, and Mary Landrieu, Bill Cassidy was a big contributor to the Landrieu campaign. Somewhere, somehow, he had an epiphany. What's going on with that?
Well, I have no idea why he gave her money, but I don't really. If you're doing polls, there's only one thing going to matter to Landrieu. How does she survive or she escapes from Obamacare? It's very unpopular in Louisiana. You can tell me all you want about what happened 6 years ago or 8 years or 10 years ago. Louisiana is totally different. If you're out there running campaigns, and I do, it's about Democrats and Obama, and all your ads are negative and they have an impact. I do Democrats and Republicans, and we're looking at, and I'm not going to be far off, but we're looking at having three or four white Democrats left in the Senate in 2016. You're talking about maybe less than 15 total white Democrats in the entire legislature. So that's the backdrop, Jim, and it's not getting better. It's getting worse. So you don't have any kind of Democratic structure like we used to have. There's no association with the party, with the business community. So I'm not saying Landrieu can win, but this is a different, I mean, it is totally mm-hmm. different.
But most of the state is still registered Democratic. It, not most of the state. Not. I retract that. It's not 50% anymore, a little over, but it's certainly more than the Republican Party, more than 2-1. Independents
don't vote that big, but when they do, they vote Republican. Look, nobody has won a statewide election since Landrieu is a Democrat, and this is her first time trying this. I mean, you can't – John Bel Edwards says he's going to run, but I don't – I'm not, unless he gets something
run
happens
for governor.
Dramatically, it's just different. And I'm not talking, this is somebody who's talking about who looks at it, mm-hmm. and I go to recruit candidates or talk to candidates, and when I'm working for a Democrat, the money is enormously against my candidate. I mean, we're not talking about small, we're talking about huge dollars.
So if it's John Bel Edwards against David Vitter, governor, which it could be in a runoff with an open primary, that's probably the betting money right now would be on that outcome.
Yeah, although, that's the most likely scenario.
So what happens? Vitter is a wounded candidate, but didn't hurt him in this last go-around. Edwards is a largely unknown, but he's a West Point guy. He's a moderate. He's certainly in favor of gun rights and against abortion. He's taken conservative stands on some social issues that might get him some swing votes. Could he beat David Vitter?
I would say probably not, but I'm not going to say it's impossible. It's just tough for a Democrat to win statewide. I mean, when is the last time that's happened?
Well, you said it was Mary Landrieu, and I'm thinking Democrats certainly didn't win the last cycle in 15, and I don't guess any Democrats won in 11 either. So Bernie makes a good point that the last time a Democrat won an election in Louisiana statewide was 2008.
Yes.
But President Obama didn't win here either.
No. It's not impossible for her to win, but this time, and I'll say it once, she's swimming against an incredible, huge wave that's going the wrong way. So I'm not saying she can or she cannot, except this is going to be, all of those other races don't mean anything compared to this race. Nothing.
Okay. And I don't guess there's any chance that the senator will change parties.
No, I think she's comfortable. I think Mary Landrieu's decided that, hey, this is who I am and what I am. She's voting with Barack Obama. She's voting with the Democratic Party just about every vote. I think this is who I am. This is where I am. If you like me, reelect me. If you don't, I don't really care. And look, I work for a U.S. Senator. Most senators return to Louisiana and become much more conservative as they run the last couple of years, and she hasn't done that.
Paul in Opelousas. Paul, good morning. You're on with Bernie Pinsonet.
Yes, sir. This is Paul. Just a question. We're concerned in this area about the Rodney Alexander replacement election. I think it's Mr. Holloway. How do you see him doing? Because really in our area, we see nothing about the election. It's just like it's going to happen, but nobody knows who's actually running. So we're going to see Clyde Holloway and Mr. Reiser.
All right, that election is 2 weeks from today. There almost certainly will be a runoff. Neil Reiser will be one of the people in the runoff, almost certainly. So what happens on October 19th?
I really don't know. All the polls I saw and were pre-Holloway, and I haven't seen a poll since then. When Clyde Holloway got in, I think the race kind of flipped upside down, and there was if anyone had any huge advantage, and you've now got two or three or four candidates who come up with a decent amount of money, and it's all about turnout. And look, polls are hard to predict when you get down to 15-28% turnouts. I mean, that's what's called a super chronic.
297-5633, 877-217-5757 for Bernie Pinsonet, who is driving a nail in the political coffin of Mary Landrieu, unless something changes. You think this is going to be a daunting effort for her?
I think it's a tough re-election. I don't know. I don't know what it'll be like next year. We have a lot of things going on, in Washington that can change the landscapes. We have things going on here in Louisiana. How will the outcome of whatever happens with this, you know, to the death battle up there, will it affect enough what we call lower-income white Democrats who come back home to the Democratic Party? They haven't been there in the last 8-10 years.
Well, I've commented on this show that I thought Landrieu's chances for re-election would have been enhanced by a Romney victory.
Absolutely.
That when President Obama won, that the tide for her re-election turned against her. But the fact that she has a fighting chance is significant. And Raymond Strother, a man you know well, he says the fact that she's a woman helps because there is some crossover voting from independents and Republicans for a woman that would not be there if it were a man with the same
Raymond
position.
Missed the Arkansas election?
Well, he was involved with Blanche Lambert Lincoln.
Well, I watched it and was on the sidelines involved in it to an extent, and I didn't think the Republican was that good a candidate. They gave her the Senate Agricultural Committee, which in Arkansas is a huge deal. I mean, that is kind of their area, and they gave her that, and the polls hadn't closed 40 minutes, and they announced that she had been stomped. And that state is more moderate than Louisiana. So explain that to me, Raymond.
Well, she did have some things going against her that Landrieu will not. There was a Democratic primary, and my former grade school and high school classmate Bill Halter ran to the left of her and hurt her. And she was wounded going into her battle for reelection. And Landrieu has a clear path. There won't be any Democrats running against her unless something really unusual happens.
Well, there was one issue that dominated it, and I think it's going to be the issue here. I think Mary would be more 50-50 but for one vote, and that's what everybody's looking at. How will Obama, Affordable Care Act affect Mary Landrieu? She may survive it, she may not. I am not sitting here saying she's dead as a doornail. I'm saying that this election is different. If she wins, it will be a much more satisfying victory because the odds at this time are against her. But that doesn't mean she can't win. But I've always said going into every one of these, and it's a matter of public record, I think Landrieu will win. I think the candidates weren't up to it, and this time the playing field is different.
Well, we'll talk about the viability of Congressman Bill Cassidy, who 10 years ago was a staunch Democrat helping Kathleen Blanco beat Bobby Jindal. He entered politics a few years later and had an epiphany and has now become a conservative Republican who is now a threat to become the U.S. Senator unseating Mary Loretta Landrieu.
But that includes half the legislature.
No, but he was an activist. He wasn't just a Democrat who voted. He was actively supporting Democrats like Blanco and Landrieu.
This is what I like about him. I like him having worked at the charity, and I think that is a plus for him.
Well, we'll talk about that as well with Bernie Pinsonat. 297-5633 is your number. Back after this 90-second pause on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Engster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. 877-217-5757 and EngsterShow@WRKF.org. Bernie Pinsonat, perhaps the best-known pollster in Louisiana, is with us, and he is discussing the 2014 Senate race, and we will talk with him about the implications of the government shutdown, too. And Bernie, I'm sure, will have some cogent remarks on that. Bonnie on Perkins. Bonnie, good morning. You're on the air with Bernie.
Oh, hi. Yeah, I was just calling to ask you about your comment about the dwindling number of white Democrats that we have. How is that indicative of a lack of structure?
You mean the number of
white elected Democrats?
White elected Democrats? Primarily I'm talking about the legislature and statewide, it's very difficult for a white Democratic candidate to run against a Republican because, number one, and Mary will have the Democratic PACs to come in and balance it out, but in Louisiana you have the Republican PAC, you got the Vitter PAC, you got the Lane Grigsby PAC, you got the Governor's PAC, you got Lobby's PAC. Lobby tends to go with Democrats no matter what. I mean, Republicans or Democrats if you're pro-business. But you're talking about five or six PACs, and you're talking about they can put in, they can put $150,000 to $200,000 in the negative ads or mail outs or robocalls.
Well,
it's very difficult for a white Democrat to win.
In an ordinary race, you're right. But Mary Landrieu won't have any trouble raising money.
I'm saying that it doesn't apply to her, but the reason we have so few white Democrats left in the House and the Senate and why we don't have any going to Congress is it's very difficult mm-hmm. to match the money the Republicans have now.
Now, Lane Grigsby, your friend and a fine fellow, he certainly has been accused of getting Michael Jackson in that congressional race with Don Cashew and Bill Cassidy. And if you remember, in 2008, Cashew got 48%. Cassidy got 40, and Michael Jackson got 12, forced it into a runoff, and Congressman Cassidy won. That's just politics, but the African American vote is always a factor, and Democrats, including Senator Landrieu, they get a large portion of that, over 90%, and that's over 30% of the electorate if blacks vote proportionately. So Senator Landrieu, Bernie, will only need about 35% of the white vote to win. The question is, can she get it?
Well, nobody's got it lately, so she would be bucking the trend. I mean, it's difficult. And it's really not 35%. It's more than that. There was a lot of discussion about the huge African-American turnout for President, then candidate Obama, and my comments were because of the candidate Obama being what we thought was anti oil and gas, the national health care, and all the government stuff, which doesn't play well in the South, and it wasn't just Louisiana, it was throughout the South, that the whites would turn out heavier, and they did. If there's a 10% higher turnout of whites, then you need more than 35, closer to 40.
All right, well, African-Americans are about 32% of the state's population.
No, 29.
Of the state's population?
Yeah. It's 29, and then you have others. So,
all right, let's say African-Americans vote at 25% of the overall vote, and Landrieu gets 24 of that 25, then she would need 26 of the remaining 75% to win. That's 34.7%.
Yeah.
So 35%. 2975633. HB in Denham Springs, you're on with Bernie.
Good morning, Mr. Bernie. One quick question here. With voter apathy being what it is and voter turnout real low in most elections in the state of Louisiana, do you think that this will have any impact on the Senate race between Ms. Landrieu and Mr. Cassidy? Thank you, sir.
Yes. Well, I don't know if it will in this race, because I'm sure that they'll have the president with phone banks, I mean, robocalls and all those things soliciting blacks to get out and vote for Landrieu. But here's another thing in the statewide elections region. We haven't had a huge amount of black turnout compared to whites in a lot of these elections last year with the, you know, when you don't have a real strong Democrat. Now, Landrieu is a strong Democrat, so that's what I'm saying. In the state elections and even his congressional elections, the black turnout has been mediocre at best, and whites vote so much heavier that it's been difficult for white Democrats to win these elections. With Landrieu, I don't think that'll be the case. I think there'll be a better than average black turnout for her. Plus, that's one of the things she will have going for her, is that the president will help her get. He won't be in Louisiana campaigning, but he will be in effect. I'm sure there'll be mail outs and telephones and everything else going into a black community urging her voters to get out, and he'll probably be leading the charge for her.
I'm looking at the 2010 census, Bernie. This is from the U.S. Census Bureau. Louisiana's population has the second largest proportion of black Americans, 32.1% in the U.S., behind neighboring Mississippi, 36.3%. Now, the voting registration may be 29%.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Okay, all right. But the overall population is 32%.
Yeah, it's a slightly over 29%. It may be two.
So when you conduct a poll, like you did with Governor Jindal, do you get 29% of African Americans, or do you get like 25 or 24, whatever the voting proportion usually is?
If we're looking at an election, we're gonna base the poll on what do we think the turnout will be, because the turnout decides. But if we're doing a public opinion poll on people's opinions about issues, then we balance that poll to represent the appropriate number of white, Hispanic, or whatever. If I'm calling an election, then I'm going to, especially if I know it's going to be a light turnout, and I can, Buster and I have done this long enough, we'll get pretty close. But if I'm doing an opinion of voters on how they feel about health care or whatever, I'm not going to do people who are not voters, because if you don't vote, I don't really care what your opinion is. But I'm going to ask all the 29% of the poll will consist of African-American voters and their opinions.
Okay. Here's a release from the Democratic Party today. It says the Louisiana Democratic Party is calling on colleagues of Representative John Fleming to condemn remarks by the Louisiana Republican that suggested the Affordable Care Act, which began enrolling thousands of uninsured Americans, is comparable to slavery or segregation. As first reported by The Nation during a radio interview this week, Fleming agreed with a caller that compared slavery and segregation to the Affordable Care Act, saying, "I think your caller is precisely correct. Whenever there's a bad law, it can be repealed or nullified." Is this just political talk, or is it there really some meat here as far as the intense
feelings? It's political misspeak.
From whom?
From Fleming.
From Fleming, who is one of the 30 Republicans who are credited or blamed, depending on your point of view.
I don't think, look, I've been doing this, in those type of comments referencing something like slavery to the Affordable Care Act is not a very smart thing to do. It doesn't do anything to help the situation. It only, it might benefit the Democrats in Washington using it as national publicity. So, yeah, you try to avoid those type of things. And look, that's what Senate race is about. Look, if you're Landrieu or Cassidy and you go out and do something like that, you may be winning, but a couple tongue slips like that and all of a sudden you start losing voters. So, yeah, you just try to avoid those type of things. And I don't know, you're just better off not inciting emotions with that kind of comment, period.
What about the debate on Capitol Hill right now that is still ongoing, and we're facing an October 17th date for the government really going in arrears, not being able to pay its bills if there isn't some sort of a compromise? Who's winning right now?
I think the Democrats are winning, but I am surprised that we got to this famous shutdown, and this is nothing like it was under when it happened with Newt Gingrich and Clinton. Regardless of what they're saying, I don't really find people on the street. They may have opinions on whether they like it or not, but the dire consequences that, and the incredibly emotion because of the pain and suffering isn't there on this one. It's a lot of rancor, and it's a lot of, but if you're one of the 800,000 people who have been furloughed, sure, but I don't know. One of the things I am a little surprised is the average person, I don't know if they, the Democrats better be careful with this, because if there's no more pain and suffering than this, you just don't want to go down this road too often.
Well, Bernie, as we close with you, today is the 70th birthday of your good friend Buddy Romer. Charles E. Buddy Romer probably had breakfast at Waffle House this morning. He'll be on this show next week. What's his legacy in Louisiana politics?
Yeah, he was elected governor. He was a congressman. Once you've been elected governor, you have a legacy, and like I told you,
is it
people,
a good one?
I don't know of too many governors that have real bad legacies. I think it's once you've been out of office past 4 or 5 years, very few people.
Well, I recently read an Advocate front page that referred to Edwin Edwards. I mean, at the top of the page is a crooked governor.
Well, that's not the average person. I'll tell you how legacies go in my mind, and that's what I see. And governors ought to realize one thing. It's more about likability in the long run. If a lot of people like you, and they will make up things about what they think you did. If they didn't like you as governor. But over time, everybody's mm-hmm. legacy mellows, and people remember you fondly because you were there. So I've never been hung up on legacy.
All right. Well, Bernie Pinsonat, your legacy as a pollster is a good one, and we'll be calling on you again soon, certainly when you do your next poll. And you say the governor's 38% approval rating should be up a bit?
I would think so. I don't know, but we'll find out because I'll be back here probably in 6 or 7 weeks, and we'll talk about it.
I like that. Thank you, Bernie. Take care. We're joined now by Sarah Lean in our remaining moment. She is National Geographic Magazine's Director of Photography. Good morning, Sarah.
Hello, how are you?
Doing well. And you conceptualized the 125th anniversary issue, overseeing all the photographic projects, and no magazine is more synonymous with photography than National Geographic.
Yes, I would love to take all the credit, but it really, you know, took a village to put this thing together. We had, you know, 6 photographers work on projects that they're near and dear to their heart, plus all the photo editors and everything. But it was really a labor of love, and you know, photography is in National Geographic's DNA, and we really believe in the power that photographs have to tell stories and connect people to the world and hopefully make people care.
The October issue is called The Power of Photography. Do pictures often say more than words?
I think they say things differently than words. It's much more emotional in some ways, I think, and this nonverbal, you look at something and it goes into your eyes and it kind of can grab a hold of your heart. And it's a very felt experience looking at photographs. So I think they move you in a very different sort of way than words do. You know, I love words. I love to read, and they're part and parcel of our legacy and the way we tell stories. But we chose to really celebrate our photographic history and our future in this issue.
Sarah Lean, the director of photography for the National Geographic. That's quite a gig. You're talking about being in charge of the area that's most known for one of the world's great publications. I'm sure it's quite an honor for you.
It is a complete honor and a privilege to do this work, and you know, I'm clinging to it with all my might because it's such a special position to have here at the Society. I really have the wonderful opportunity to work with so many talented photographers and the photo editors here on staff. You know, we can choose from the cream of the crop for our stories, and it's really wonderful. Like this morning where I sent a couple of emails out offering 2 photographers and news stories, and it's like you feel like Santa Claus. It's just wonderful.
Well, National Geographic created the first photographic survey of the night sky in the northern hemisphere, the first color photographs of undersea. It has an impact on the culture that is quite profound. I think it probably has moved the masses as much or more than any other print publication.
Yes, we have from small to large, we have had different impacts all the way from money that was raised for a young boy in Peru whose sheep were run over, and we published a picture of him, and readers poured money in, and we were able to replace his flock of sheep, all the way to a series of stories we did in Africa, in the Congo, and Gabon. And the resulting work from that helped create 11 new national parks in the country of Gabon. So whenever we can have that kind of impact, which is not all that often, it's very difficult, change is slow, it's, you know, we're very happy, very proud, and it is definitely a goal.
And it was a 1916 article in the magazine that spurred the establishment of the national parks.
That's right. And we were also influential in helping get land and donate it to Sequoia National Park. But we're very, love our parks, and we have one of the stories in this October issue is some really beautiful and very interesting landscape photographs from national parks.
Well, thank you, Sarah Lean. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you having me.
My pleasure. And I did want to note, in the 2008 congressional election, it was Cassidy 48, Cashew 40, and Jackson 12. And if Jackson's 12 had gone to Cashew, he would have retained control of his House seat. Did not happen. Thank you for listening, everybody. We'll be back Monday. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.